With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, the increasing costs for California growers to monitor. We'll have more about that. But our top story today, even though House Ag Chairman Glenn G.T. Thompson has said that a new farm bill will be introduced, without a doubt, by Memorial Day, the ranking member of the Senate Ag Committee says he wants to make sure the farm bill is done right. C.J. Miller has more.
Republican Senator John Bozeman from Arkansas says he wants a new farm bill to be able to meet the needs of America's farmers over the next 5 years.
And so to commit our farmers, not just 1 year, but a five-year contract, because we take this very seriously in Congress. Once we set this, then it is a contract with our farmers. We don't allow other entities like transportation to steal the money and this and that. Again, you know, it is a contract. So we've got to get it right.
With so many different changes to the U.S. economy since the last farm bill was passed in 2018, including a rise in inflation and interest rate hikes, Bozeman says that the risk management component is very important.
The first thing is making sure that the risk management tools are there so that our farmers can go to the bank, borrow the money that they need, and know that they're taking huge risk, but at least there is a bottom to that risk, and that's through crop insurance, ARC, PLC, programs like that.
He adds that ag trade is another important aspect of a new farm bill.
Trade is the lifeblood of agriculture. Last year, we had essentially the first time in 50 years, we had a trade imbalance in agriculture. That's always the bright star. So we need to do a much better job with trade. Nobody wants to put all their eggs in the China basket anymore. And so there's a lot of opportunities, but to be honest, the administration is simply not following through.
I'm CJ Miller.
The latest consumer price index reporting covering March shows food price inflation at the grocery store grinding to a halt. Gary Crawford has more.
The government's consumer price index for March has been getting a lot of serious attention, serious press, because it showed an unexpectedly high rate of annual inflation, 3.5% in the general economy, and it recorded a fairly high one-month increase of 0.6%. However, experts say, unlike during the COVID pandemic when food prices were soaring, you cannot blame this new run of inflation on food. In fact,
food at home or grocery prices were actually flat in March.
No increase at all. This from Agriculture Department economist Megan Schweitzer, who told us,
overall, we continue to see inflation slow or stabilize across both of the major categories of food for groceries and restaurant products. And so while food prices are still increasing, particularly on the restaurant side, food is not one of the major contributors to inflation on an economy-wide scale in March.
Not at all.
Overall, what was really driving price increases across the economy in March this year were the categories of shelter and of energy, particularly gasoline.
Yes, gas prices rose by almost 6.5% last month. Now, you would think higher gas prices means higher transportation costs, and that would push up the cost of food. And Megan Schweitzer says, yes.
Energy prices are an input into the food production process, but it's one of many components that feeds into food prices. Food processing and packaging and wholesaling and retailing, and so you have all of these factors feeding into food prices.
But they didn't feed in enough to raise retail prices during March. In fact, she says that last month, of the 15 major food categories that she tracks, prices went up for 9 of them, down for 6.
For the most part, we saw prices increase for categories across the meats, poultry, and fish categories. Prices declined for dairy products, for fats and oils, sugar and sweets, cereals and bakery products, and for fresh fruits and fresh vegetables.
Leading overall grocery store food prices up from this time a year ago by only 1.2%. Oh, and Schweitzer says some foods are selling for less than a year ago, namely eggs, dairy products, and fish and seafood. On the other side of the scale, beef prices are rising rapidly. Last month, prices averaged about 7.5% higher than March of 1 year ago. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen. In today's National Spotlight, the United Soybean Board recently traveled on a See for Yourself mission to Colombia and Panama. Chad Smith reports.
The mission allowed farmers to see how soy checkoff investments impact other parts of the world and provide a return on investment. Philip Good, a Mississippi farmer, says it was very educational.
I had the opportunity to lead a group of young farmer participants that are just an outstanding group of young farmers from various states. And we had the opportunity to journey to Panama and Colombia, where we saw firsthand the Panama Canal. We visited an aquaculture farm, a fish processing plant, and a feed mill.
One of the best parts of the trip was seeing the results of checkoff investments.
It was great both for myself and for the participants to actually see the projects that we've invested in to increase demand. So I'm a catfish farmer and I have the opportunity to see what nutritious, sustainable soy does for my catfish. But then we were able to see what it did for another country. Last year, being able to see soybean meal being loaded on ships for this port to Colombia, it was a great opportunity to see where it actually landed. Visiting this aquaculture farm, we were able to see the efficiencies there, hear what they're doing, and then actually seeing that product all the way through the processing plant. Soybeans are giving employment opportunities. It's helping producers there. It's providing food.
As a catfish farmer, Good says their aquaculture farming was especially interesting.
Their difference there is these are actually a raceway system, so it's very much high tech where they are concentrating the fish, increasing the oxygen, increasing feeding rates, increasing the use of U.S. soy meal. All those are helping to drive our demand for U.S. soybean meal here in the United States.
For more information on the application and to read blog posts of the farmer participants, visit unitedsoybeanboard.com/see-for-yourself. Chad Smith reporting.
Each week, USDA gives us a comprehensive snapshot of the progress and condition of U.S. crops. Gary Crawford has more on this major effort.
Every Monday afternoon, the Agriculture Department releases what is called a Crop Progress Report. You may get the highlights of it on this radio station, in fact. It gives the condition of various crops, where they are in their development, how much has been planted and harvested. It's done by state and then on a national scale. And you can imagine,
it is getting a lot of attention.
Lance Honig with the USDA Statistics Service. Of course, farmers and traders are all wondering every week what this report will show. Honig says farmers and the markets rely on this report. And getting the local reports for this national assessment every week, that's a huge undertaking.
We actually have about 4,000 reporters that we contact each week to fill out these reports. Our goal is to have a report for every county in the United States. Now, obviously, every week we don't have every single county covered, but we've got, like most of our surveys, we shoot for about 80% coverage each week.
The assessments are done by folks like county extension agents, farm service agency people, and others. They, of course, go out and look at crops and check on planting progress and emergence. And later on in the session, the condition of the crops.
And they're also in contact with producers in their area. They're spending time traveling around their county during the week. So it's based on not only firsthand observations, but they are also, in many cases, getting input from the producers themselves.
Now, of course, tracking how much crop's been planted, that's a pretty straightforward job, but a lot of what they gather is subjective later on when it gets to the condition of the crop and how it's changed from the past week. But
we do give them very specific direction and guidelines as to how they're to report, how the different stages are defined and things of that nature. So even though they're subjective reports, they're based on standardized definitions.
And then every Monday morning, they send in those reports to USDA headquarters, thousands of reports.
And we've got an individual in here who works very feverishly throughout the afternoon to compile all that data and to get that report together to be released at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Happens week in and week out.
And so farmers and grain traders and many others will be anxiously awaiting this next Monday when USDA will once again give us the latest national snapshot of the crop situation and the condition of the nation's rangelands and pastures. Monday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 Central. In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's National Spotlight. In livestock news, a highly pathogenic avian influenza outbreak in dairy cattle herds is making news headlines and causing concern among consumers. Adam Brock is the administrator of the Division of Food and Recreational Safety for the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture. He says consumers need to know that the U.S. milk supply is safe.
Yeah, that's correct. There is a very low risk of anybody contracting avian influenza from their milk supply. There's procedures and hurdles in place. And as always, pasteurized milk you get from your local Quick Trip or wherever you're going, that's all going to be pasteurized. Your cheese is all taken care of. Plenty of food safety hurdles, so milk is not a concern. I would not be concerned drinking milk. In fact, I had some this morning.
He says the pasteurization process takes all kinds of things out of the milk supply.
Exactly. I mean, pasteurization inhibits and it reduces the growth of bacteria. You know, it takes care of pathogens, viruses, and different things. So as long as you're drinking pasteurized milk, eating pasteurized cheese, which is only available on the market, you're in good shape. So 99% of consumers, to be transparent, there are some raw cheese makers in the U.S., right, and some in Wisconsin, but right now, not a concern. You know, I know we're talking milk safety, but for those of you that eat your eggs and your meat, it's also safe.
In other livestock news, 2023 was a rough year for U.S. pork producers. During a recent press conference, National Pork Producers Council CEO Brian Humphreys had more optimism for the rest of 2024.
And I think there's some opportunity for optimism as we look at 2024. And part of that is with an increase in domestic consumption. The other part of it is with a reduced input cost. One of the things that's worth noting, though, for the American pork producer is that there are some fixed expenses. When we talk about interest, we talk about labor, we talk about capital improvements that are up almost 20%. And when you add that into the baseline of pork production, you have some significant challenges in being cost competitive. And so we look forward to hopefully a profitable year for our industry in 24, recognizing the headwinds that we ran into in late 22 and all of 23.
Almost 100 pork producers took part in the NPPC's annual fly-in to Washington, D.C. NPPC President Lori Stevermer says they have several topics to discuss with lawmakers. One of the biggest concerns is an adequate labor supply.
I think there are, as we alluded to, a number of issues. I mean, with Prop 12 still on individuals' minds, I will say labor is becoming a big concern with a lot of our farms. It's probably the one topic that I'm starting to get more questions on, more comments from our farms, whether it's the TNs or H2As, but just really a concern about that ability for our farms to have labor long term.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. With today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director Brian German.
Growers are facing cost increases in a variety of areas. President and CEO of the Western Agricultural Processors Association, Roger Isom, highlighted some of the fee increases growers are paying close attention to.
Well, I think the current one right now that people are watching is this mill tax legislation that's going through the budget committee hearings. I think people are watching that to see, is it going to cost me more for pesticides, and if so, how much? And what is DPR doing with that, right? They're really strangling us right now by eliminating more and more pesticides, looking at advanced notification, looking at replacing or eliminating more through their sustainable pest management program. So, you know, what's going to come from that? If they get more people and more money, so I'm going to pay more for every ounce I use. And so I think a lot of eyes are on that and seeing what's going to happen. And along these lines of fees and discussions, I mean, once again, State Water Board, you know, they're just recklessly increasing rates yet again, ignoring the concerns of the stakeholders that are having to pay those fees. Their increases, as you know, have been going up every year. They've outpaced inflation, outpaced the consumer price index, and I think they're looking at more than a 5% increase for this year. As you know, ag can't pass along that cost. How are we going to pay for it? Where are we going to get the money? It's not there, and we're not seeing anything come from that program. What's the benefit? What are they doing with that money? It's just going into a black hole, and they just recklessly increase the rates every single year.
The Association of Equipment Manufacturers, which represents over 1,000 companies worldwide, is currently accepting nominations for its 2024 Hall of Fame. The AEM Hall of Fame recognizes pioneers, inventors, and leaders who have made lasting impacts on the off-road equipment industry. Inductees must demonstrate innovation, industry contributions, leadership, and corporate citizenship. The deadline for nominations for 2024 induction is June 14th. Since 2008, the Hall of Fame has honored influential figures in the agriculture and construction equipment manufacturing sectors who have helped to shape the industry. AEM President Megan Tannell emphasized the crucial role of these individuals in shaping the world, acknowledging their efforts in building, powering, and sustaining global communities. More information about the Hall of Fame and how to submit nominations is available at AEM.org. While agricultural exports of some high-value products have improved over last year, the latest figures show that other exports, such as bulk commodities, are down by approximately 21%. USDA economist Bart Kinner explained some of the U.S. ag trade numbers for the first 5 months of this fiscal year.
Agricultural exports for fiscal year-to-date, October through February 2024, $78.9 billion, a 7% decrease from the previous year. Agricultural imports are $82.9 billion through February of fiscal year 24, which reflects a 2% increase from fiscal year 23, for a trade balance of negative $4.1 billion, which is $7.2 billion lower than the trade balance at this point last year.
Shifts in citrus production in California are giving reason for optimism. General Manager of Cobblestone Fruit in Fresno County, Colby Campbell, explains where he sees future potential for citrus.
I'm still confident and bullish on the mandarins that are grown here in California. The Tango Mandarin in particular, you know, you don't have to net it. They crop really well. But from what I see and from my experience, the usage, right, we grew up eating oranges. And you would eat an orange, we had to peel it, you had this process that took place, but you very rarely went back for a second one. And what I feel like for the mandarin grown here in California, the demand continues to absorb and take, you know, everything that we produce. We do have heavy crop years where when you have a lot of fruit in a window, it's difficult to move. So I know the industry is focusing on how do we spread that out to make sure, you know, how do we hold later? How do we make sure that we can utilize everything that we're producing? Because you've got kids these days that are growing up, you know, eating these mandarins that are different than what we did when we were kids or our generation. And I feel like you're developing going forward that generation when they're older and in our shoes, they're going to continue to buy these mandarins for their kids because they come back, they eat multiple at once typically. You know, mom can grab it and put it in a lunch bill. You've got a four-year-old or five-year-old kid's capable of peeling it and eating it themselves rather than having, you know, their parent help them.
The UC Davis Veterinary Genetics Laboratory has been announced as the newest research tenant in Aggie Square, a collaborative innovation district partnered with Wexford Science and Technology. Renowned for its pioneering work in animal DNA testing and genetics, VGL will occupy a 25,000-square-foot space in Aggie Square's Building on the Square, expanding beyond the Davis campus into Sacramento. With expertise in over 20 species, VGL aims to optimize genetic testing procedures and advance animal health. The move will reportedly facilitate educational programs, industry partnerships, and research collaborations, furthering the One Health initiative to improve human, animal, and environmental well-being. The relocation will provide VGL with state-of-the-art facilities, enabling rapid innovation and collaboration with industry partners. The laboratory is scheduled to become operational in 2025. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Several aspects about decision makers on the farm and ranch level are discovered when combing through the data of the 2022 Census of Agriculture. Rod Bain looks at some of those findings in the first part of a two-part series in this edition of Agriculture USA.
The Census of Agriculture, the premier data set regarding farming, ranching, food, feed, and fiber production in our nation. The latest edition of the census, covering the year 2022, provided the Agriculture Department and census users and stakeholders opportunity to learn more about the people within the ag sector.
It's a highlight because it gives us a snapshot of those involved with farm decision making.
I'm Rod Bain. Virginia Harris of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service joins us as we look at the demographics of the 2022 Census of Agriculture in this edition of Agriculture USA. Demographics have always been a key data set within USDA's Census of Agriculture series. What do the numbers reveal regarding the most recent census conducted in the year 2022? National Agricultural Statistics Service statistician Virginia Harris delved into some of the demographics during this year's USDA Agricultural Outlook Forum, just days after the initial set of Census of Ag findings were released. For instance, in looking at farm producers and total farms between census,
the number of producers in 2022 decreased about 0.8% from 2017 to 3.37 million people. This is a much smaller change compared to the decrease in the number of farms, which was 6.9%. This is due to a larger share of farms reporting multiple producers.
With the number of 1 to 2 producer operated farms decreasing from the previous census of agriculture, and the number of farms operated by 3 or more growers increasing in 2022.
About 60% of all farms reported more than one person involved in farm decision making.
In terms of structure of farm operation by gender,
farms with at least one female producer are much less likely to be operated by a single person. Most women are involved in farms with other people. Just 11% of farms with a female producer have just one person involved, while men are much more likely to be operating farms as sole operators of that farming operation.
A further breakdown of data on women in farms reveals
female producers account for 36% of all producers, while almost 60%, 58% to be exact, of farms have at least one female producer on the operation. On average, farms with female producers are smaller both in acreage and in sales.
There are also notable demographics regarding female farm operators by region.
Farms in the western part of the country are much more likely to have a female producer than those farms in the Midwest.
The census, from cycle to cycle, introduces new questions to further expand understanding of what certain data objectives mean. For instance, in the 2022 census, a new question on the survey form asked about marketing decisions on the farm by gender. 61% of male producers make farm marketing decisions, while 50% of women make marketing decisions associated with the farm. Regarding other operation decision aspects,
female producers, their highest participation in decision making were in the categories of day-to-day decisions, record keeping, and financial management aspects of the farm. Male producers were much more involved than female producers in making decisions about land use and crops.
Harris acknowledges the demographic of average age for farmers usually generates interest due to increased age from census to census.
The average age of producers increased 57.5 in 2017 to 58.1 in 2022.
Yet,
absolute difference in average age is smaller than we've seen in the past few census cycles.
And regarding breakdown of average producer age by region,
producers in the Southeast and the Southwest tend to be older than the overall average.
The Census of Agriculture and its 2022 edition also spanned coverage of various demographics such as young and new and beginning farmers, producers by race, and by military service. A closer look at these data points is made in a future edition. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Many homeowners and even some lawn professionals are using the wrong type of mulch and also applying it wrongly. Gary Crawford has more.
I get people all the time calling me wanting assistance.
Isn't that nice? And Kansas State University Extension lawn and garden expert Dennis Patton happily helps, cheerfully answering questions from people, cheerfully even though he may have answered that same question 100 times. So during a recent interview, I asked what I thought was an innocent, harmless question. What kind of mulch is best to use?
Oh, boy.
Whoa, that question hit a nerve, didn't it? It's like, why did you ask that? But Dennis did answer the question in a way.
Well, to me, when it comes to mulching, the number one focus should be on the function of mulch. To keep the soil cooler, it's to conserve moisture, it's to control weeds, it's to kind of finish off the landscape. And when you get to whether wood chip versus dyed mulch versus this versus that, to me, you're really getting then into an aesthetics issue. They're all going to do the same thing if applied properly, but we get into what you like.
Uh-huh. So what does Dennis Patton like?
Most people in the horticulture field really like the wood-based products mulch.
And here's why.
They tend to break down, release nutrients to the soil. They help improve our soils through the organic matter. They're usually a local renewable resource, whereas your other types of mulches tend to be more what we call the inorganic mulches, the rock mulches, those type of things. And there's definitely places for rock mulches, but they don't always have all the benefits of a wood mulch. They don't necessarily cool the soil quite as much. They can be a little bit hotter when they absorb that heat. Depending on how they're placed, they could also become a hazard. You know, a lawnmower, pick one of those up and fling it across.
Yeah, there is that problem. But Patton says, again, the main thing is to properly apply the mulch. He says you don't need more than a couple of inches of mulch in most cases. And one thing that really drives him nuts is seeing mulch piled up high around the trunks of trees.
That's called volcano mulching, when you pile this mulch up against the trunk of the trees. And that is wrong, wrong, wrong. What it does is put that moist layer right up next to the wood that leads to rot and decay of the tree. And then, of course, that shortens the life of the tree.
Can I get away with only cutting my yard like once a year?
Oh, boy.
All right, just asking. Gary Crawford from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Joining us now is Cindy Zimmerman with the Ethanol Report.
In our last episode of the Ethanol Report, right after the National Ethanol Conference in February, you may recall we were eagerly awaiting an announcement from the Biden administration on how the GREET model would be modified to determine the eligibility of crops to make sustainable aviation fuel and qualify for tax credits under the Inflation Reduction Act. That announcement was due on March 1st. When Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack spoke to a record crowd at the Commodity Classic in Houston, Texas. By the time he took the podium, word had already leaked that the promise four federal agencies had made to have an answer by March 1st would be broken.
Obviously, we're not in a position today to announce the guidance that will be coming forth from the Treasury Department as it relates to the sustainable aviation fuel and the tax credits that will be available in 2023 and 2024, and the tax credits that will go in place in 2025 and beyond. Now, the reason we're not is because we're measuring twice and cutting once. We want to make sure that the latest and best information is utilized in the modeling that will inform the Treasury guidance. I had two goals in my conversations with my colleagues in the interagency working group. One was to ensure that the GREET model was in fact incorporated in this process. At the beginning of the process, that wasn't necessarily the case, but I'm confident now that indeed the GREET model will be part of the guidance that will be provided by Treasury. And then in connection with that GREET model, I wanted to make sure that biofuels, ethanol, biodiesel had, and the feedstocks that provide those fuels had the ability to qualify for the tax credits. And that is particularly true of those feedstocks that are generated through climate smart practices. No-till, cover crops, energy efficient fertilizer, the things that you are already using in the field to produce a wide array of the commodities that you raise. As much as I know about this and as much as you know about no-till and cover crops, and energy-efficient fertilizer and what's going on the farm, the reality is not everybody in the country is aware of it. Not everybody in the country appreciates the level to which farmers have embraced sustainable farm practices. So it's incumbent upon us at USDA to be your voice in these interagency meetings to make sure that our colleagues in other departments who don't focus on this on a daily basis are aware. So in order to get the model right, in order to get the guidance right, we're going to take a few more weeks, and I mean weeks, not months, to make sure that the guidance is correct, that it acknowledges the work that's being done in reducing greenhouse gas emissions relative to transportation fuels and the good work that's being done out in the field to embrace climate smart practices. And I'm confident that at the end of the day, folks will understand and appreciate what President Biden has understood when he said that his view, 95% of sustainable aviation fuel will be connected and produced by farmers over the next 20 years.
Secretary Vilsack explained in more detail during a press conference that basically the reason for the delay is it's complicated.
key here is basically providing a clear and understandable framework for how those who produce sustainable aviation fuel can qualify for the tax credits, specifically and primarily for 45Z. The reality is that we're going to see sort of fits and starts in the beginning of this in terms of 2023 and 2024. Right now, we only have one commercial operation producing sustainable aviation fuel, and that's at 10 million gallons, and we have to get to 3 billion by 2030. So it's going to be fits and starts. So the key here is to provide a very clear and understandable process by which folks can determine what's in and what's out. To determine what's in and what's out, there is a criteria that requires that you prove and establish that the fuel you're producing is better for the environment by a certain percentage than existing jet fuel. I think it's fair to say that there can be multiple ways that you can create a more sustainable aviation fuel. The data has to be collected and analyzed, and it has to be put through a modeling process to give you that clear and concise understanding of what's in and what isn't. That may seem like, from where you all sit, a relatively simple thing to do and it ought to be done. It's not. It's not because this is an evolving industry. The notion of sustainability, I mentioned 205 practices that are currently engaged, that we're currently engaged in with Climate Smart Agriculture in our initiative. And I've said all along that that initiative is going to tell us what works and what doesn't work. So there's still data being collected. So as you try to establish that clear directive and provide guidance, you need to make sure you've got the most recent data, the most recent science, informing the process. And that's particularly true when it comes to climate smart practices. It's particularly true of some of the things that you may have mentioned in your question, you know, no-till and cover crops and energy efficiency fertilizer. So we're, as a working group, providing information, inputting it. Now, the second issue here is that until several months ago, there wasn't consensus on which modeling and system you were supposed to use to do those calculations. That took some educating on the part of myself and others to make sure that the interagency working group understood the importance of embracing the GREET model as part of the modeling process. So it's just taken a while. There were some folks who were skeptical that GREET would actually do what we thought it would do. So we had to prove that point, which we proved it. And then now we're in the process of taking the next step. So this is going to take, I think, a matter of weeks to sort of get through this process. And once you have that clear, concise understanding of what is in and out, then you also have to have a process by which you can verify that what you say you're doing, you're actually doing. Well, that's a whole different conversation. So it's complicated, and we're working through it. And I'm, you know, certainly appreciative of the work and the support of the interagency working group. And I think we're going to get there. And I think when we get there, at the end of the day, we're going to do what needs to be done for this industry, which is to create multiple ways to get to that to that point where you can say our fuel is more environmentally beneficial than jet fuel by a certain amount and should qualify for a fairly significant tax credit, which then makes it financially feasible to produce that fuel at the beginning of this industry.
I wonder if you could clarify just a little bit. I saw from the reporting orders, they said there was a meeting of the principals at the White House yesterday. I realize this is a work in progress, but who are the principals? Who is the interagency working group that will ultimately make the decision to dot I's and cross T's?
Well, there were multiple meetings, right? Multiple meetings. Tim Gannon's right there. He was in one of those meetings yesterday. I mean, the point of this, Jeff, is It's EPA, it's USDA, it's the Treasury Department because it's their guidance. It's the Department of Transportation and the FAA because we're talking about airplanes, right? It's the Department of Energy because we're talking about energy and fuel. So it's a combination of all of those entities. Principals are in these meetings can be a number of people. They can be me, the people like me, secretaries, administrators, or they can be deputies, or they can be administrators, or they could be the chief scientist. I mean, there are multiple meetings taking place because this is quite complicated.
The big sticking point is land use change, something that Renewable Fuels Association chief economist Scott Richmond says is easily refuted by the latest Census of Agriculture showing continued decline in cropland.
Actually, if you look back, going back about 15, 20 years, the productivity is really what's driven the increase in the amount of feedstock available to the ethanol industry. About three quarters of the increase in feedstock availability has come from higher yields. Only about a quarter of it has come through increased acreage. So it's really the productivity of farmers, the technology that's gone into seed, all those sorts of things that have enabled this tremendous growth in the ethanol industry without having a large impact on farmland.
And that's it for this edition of the Ethanol Report, sponsored by the Renewable Fuels Association. For more information on RFA and ethanol, go to ethanolrfa.org.
That once again was Cindy Zimmerman. Agriculture again reduces its greenhouse gas emissions. New data released this month from the Environmental Protection Agency shows agriculture decreased its greenhouse gas emissions in 2022. The EPA recently released the inventory of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions and sinks 1990 to 2022. American Farm Bureau Federation economist Danny Munch explains the results.
Overall greenhouse gas emissions from all sources increased by 1.3% between 2021 and 2022, though agricultural emissions dropped 1.8%, and that's the largest decrease of any economic sector.
2022 marks the lowest U.S. agriculture greenhouse gas emissions since 2012.
Crop cultivation emissions were down 6 million metric tons from 2021. When we look at livestock, they were down 2.1% or 6 million metric tons from 2021. Emissions from fuel combustion in ag were down 1 million metric tons or 1.2%.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.